Elizabeth Gilbert, welcome to Booktopia.
Thank you, my dear. It's lovely to see you again.
I have to start by asking you, what are you reading at the moment? What did you read on the plane over?
Okay, I always like to be the last one on a trend, so I am reading David Mitchell. Years and years and years after everybody else has already read and discovered and loved David Mitchell. But I think I started Cloud Atlas years ago, and there are certain books, I don't know if this happens to you, where you have a bad experience in the first few pages and then you're done, and then you go back years later with some more patience and you start over and realize what a garden it is and what a treasure it is. So I'm doing it all backwards. I read The Bone Clocks first, and now I'm reading Cloud Atlas, and now but I'm just dazzled. How does a human even make something like that?
Yes, absolutely.
How do you even...
Well, you would know. You would know, actually. So we are here to talk about exactly that, about the creative impulse. And there's a question that I've been burning to ask you since I read Big Magic, which is, why do you care so much about other people getting their creativity mojo? What is it to you, as a writer, as a very successful writer, what does it matter to you that the rest of us fulfill our dreams? What kind of a mission is that?
God, I haven't thought about that. There's something terribly wrong with me. Why do I care? I could be doing so many other things with my time. Why do I care? I care because I intimately know the people who I'm speaking to. From, ever since Eat, Pray, Love invited me into a sisterhood of community with my readers that is more intimate than it would have been had I would just remain, for instance, a novelist who every few years produces a book, throws it out there, goes to book signings. People come to me at events with a great deal of presupposed intimacy, saying, I feel like I know you.
Yes.
And I don't think that's insane on their part. They do know me because I, with my typical lack of boundaries, told them every single thing about my life. And then they tend to tell me every single thing about theirs, you know? And with social media and the involvement that I've gotten into recently on Facebook, which has become a place that I dearly love and revere, these conversations have become even more intimate and even more real. And so what I'm gleaning is that there's an enormous population of people out there who somehow feel as though they have not been invited. And what they have not been invited to depends on the person, but there's a long list. I haven't been invited to have an adventurous life. I haven't been invited to explore my creativity. I haven't been invited to have permission to leave a bad relationship. I haven't been invited to believe that my body is my own. There's all these women who still feel somehow that they never got an invitation. And women seem to need, not all women, but a great deal of women seem to need a permission slip from the principal's office, a note from an authority, or an engraved invitation in order to participate in things that you and I might think are just our right, you know?
Yeah.
So when I realized that for whatever reason they tend to listen to me when I speak, I thought, well, what's a good use of me having the soapbox? I'm going to write a giant engraved permission slip to particularly my female readers, saying, you are absolutely invited. You are hereby not only invited, but maybe even instructed to look for whatever the thing is in your life that will make you feel like you are not just a meat puppet here to pay bills and wait to die. That there is some sort of a spark within you, that there is some sort of treasure within you, that there's something you want to make, there's a handprint you want to leave on your life that says you are here in some bigger way than the way that you're currently living. And yes, you can. Of course you can. All of you.
And of course, Eat, Pray, Love, you've seen the fruits of that, because now we're about to get Eat, Pray, Love, Made Me Do It. Or
right.
Made Me Do That.
Made Me Do It.
Made Me Do It.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is an anthology of people who've written to you on the anniversary, the 10th anniversary of the book. Is it the 10th anniversary?
It is the 10th anniversary. Last week was the 10th anniversary of the
Happy birthday,
book. Thank you. Yeah, wow.
And so what's the wildest thing in that collection of stories?
Oh, God, there's so many wonderful ones. To me, the things that strike me are not the wild, but the subtle and the small that make all the difference. Because I think sometimes people get this idea that everyone's looking for the lightning in the jar moment. Everybody's looking for Moses to come down from the mountains and to have a sort of Charlton Heston voice of God telling you how to change your life in some big dramatic way. oftentimes the transformations that people make in their life in these tiny sort of ways, views of perspective, can mean everything. And the one actually that you may be surprised that delights me the most is the woman who wrote an essay saying, "Your book, Eat, Pray, Love, gave me permission to not be a traveler, to realize that I hate traveling." And because she'd grown up in a family of adventurers and travelers, and she'd spent her life with this very dutiful, heavy obligation to feel like it was her responsibility to see the world. And so she'd been doing that her whole life, but she didn't like it. It wasn't her thing. And when she read Eat, Pray, Love and saw what a passionate love of travel looks like, and realized that that wasn't her, she said, "I'm done. All I want is a garden and a house and stability and a community and a village and to never move and to be part of an ongoing seasonal revelation of what it means to live within the bosom of a small, intimate community where everyone knows you year after year after year. I'm done." And that's so cool. Brilliant. Because that's more exciting to me than somebody reading the book and saying, "I also now need to go to that ashram in India to eat that pizza in Italy, to meet that Brazilian in Bali." No, the point is not that you do what I did.
No.
The point is that you give yourself, once again, permission to ask that most dangerous and magnificent question: how is it that I want to live? And why have I not given myself the right to live the way I want to? And is it so far off? Is it so out of reach? Maybe not.
Do you think, Liz, that if you hadn't written Eat, Pray, Love, is it the kind of book that you yourself would have read?
At that moment in my life, absolutely. I was reading lots of books like that at that moment in my life, which is why I have no snobbery about the self-help genre. I think there are times in our lives when we need assistance. And I just saw a sort of wonderful essay by Neil Gaiman where he was explaining what genre is, and he was saying, you know, essentially 90% of it is dross and then 10% of it is good. So 90% of science fiction is terrible and then 10% of it is amazing, and then you have David Mitchell.
Yeah.
Right? And so with self-help, it's the same. 90% of it is garbage, 10% of it might be kind of one or two helpful things in there, and then you have Brené Brown. Right? You know, so to dismiss entire genres as though if you're an intelligent thinking person, there's nothing in there for you is just quite small-minded and may actually not benefit your life at all. So I would have read it. In fact, I think at most points in my life, with the exception of Big Magic, I think with most points in my life, I usually write the book that at that point in my life I would most like to read. Mm. Big Magic was not that. Big Magic was a book that I really wrote for other people in another way.
Eat, Pray, Love did spawn a lot of parodies. There's one, I think there's a guy called Andrew Gottlieb who wrote Drink, Play, Fuck. Yeah, and I was just wondering whether you have a favourite parody or whether there was any joke that anybody made about Eat, Pray, Love as a phenomenon that made you laugh and made you think, yeah, that's pretty funny.
All of them make me laugh. I think the one that I delighted in the most was Sacha Baron Cohen when he played the Dictator. Is that the name of that film? I think it's called The Dictator. And there's a moment where he's on a bridge thinking of jumping off and he just says, "I just want to have my Eat, Pray, Love moment." And it was so, it's always funny for me when I'm not seeing it coming, when I'm in a movie theater enjoying a ridiculous, stupid Sacha Baron Cohen comedy and all of a sudden I'm like, "Oh my god," and there it is. And it became shorthand for something.
Yes.
Very efficiently. And that's fine. You know, most of us live our lives in shorthand anyway, so it's all right.
Now with Big Magic, with a lot of the sort of social media that you've done around the book, it's become clear that you've dabbled a little bit in painting and drawing, and you love karaoke, and you're perfectly happy dancing in public as well. Is there anything that you really would love to be able to do that you yourself creatively cannot do, that you've just found, I have a cloth ear or right, whatever?
All those things that you mentioned, by the way, I'm not good at those things. Just because I'm doing them doesn't mean that I have a gift for them. You know, I would love, I mean, if I had a wish to have another different kind of life, I think the coolest thing you could possibly be is a singer-songwriter. I think right, the idea of being that really cool woman in the corner of the roadhouse with the guitar, the
Jenny
smoky
Mitchell
light is pretty, yeah. Mm-hmm. You can't really be cooler than that.
Right.
You know, Joni Mitchell, you know, even Patti Smith, I mean, if you want to go like really double down on cool, you know, just the idea of not just having a voice, but having a voice, you know, is something pretty incredible. But I'm working with my friend Rhea, who you know, Rhea Elias, who's an author and a musician. We're writing some songs together because she's a musician. So we're going to go back and go in the recording studio. But I'm a faker because I can't play anything and I can barely sing. But it's worth the stakes. When it's not your field, there are no stakes. You can always just say at the end if it doesn't work, hey, look, it's not my game. I never said I was a singer.
But don't you think there's also a key thing, which is that you have to be willing to make a fool of yourself. You know, when you're learning a language, one of the things about it is you can't be proud. No. You have to just throw it out there and people will kind of think, oh my God, she's just mangled that. But at least you tried.
If they're thinking about you at all, which they most likely are not. You know, I think one of the most liberating pieces of advice that I was ever given was from this amazing older woman who was an artist who I revered, who said to me, you know, women especially, we spend our teens and our 20s and our 30s so concerned about what everybody's thinking of us, and we don't really start to become free until our 40s and 50s, when we decide with a great deal of power and fierceness that we don't give a shit what anybody thinks about us. But she said, you won't really, really be fully liberated until generally around your 60s and 70s, when you finally realize nobody was ever thinking about you anyway. They were thinking about themselves. Human beings spend their entire day thinking about themselves. You know, that your presence on their radar screen is a blip that very quickly disappears into their own anxieties and their own issues and their own self-obsessions and their own fears. So if you can remember that, it becomes a lot easier to make something. And even with Eat, Pray, Love, even a book that got as much attention as it got, people gave it, you know, no one's thinking about it 24 hours a day.
No.
People read it, it meant something to them, and then they went back to the business of their own business. It comes and goes.
You do spend a lot of time thinking about other people that you've never met and will never meet. You started a really fantastic initiative late last year around compassion. And you did it with Cheryl Strayed, who wrote Wild, and you did it with your great friend Brené Brown, who's so fantastic about all sorts of ways of kind of making your life more positive and affirmative. Tell me about the Compassion Collective and what its mission is and what it's doing.
It started, I get frustrated. It's a frustrating moment to be an American. It often is a frustrating moment to be an American. at this moment particularly, may I say. And there's a point at which I get weary of listening to other people and myself just complain about how terribly things are being handled. And there's a moment at which I just think, well, what are we doing about it? It's funny, I was in a taxi in a car ride recently. This is the most boring line of conversation that I think there is. This car driver who I started talking to, who just went into, you know, people don't care about people anymore, and nobody's like, and I just thought, we could do this all day, or we can care about people in an active way. So, and I wanted to say to him, what are you doing about caring about people other than saying that people don't care about people? What are you doing? What am I doing other than complaining about humanity? You know, it's tedious. It's just tedious. You have agency. I have agency.
Yeah.
Right before Christmas, I sent a few emails out to Brené Brown, to Cheryl Strayed, to Glennon Doyle Melton, who is this fantastic writer who wrote a book called Love Warrior, has an amazing blog called The Momastery. She's somebody to keep your eye on.
Okay.
And Pastor Rob Bell, who wrote Love Wins, who's fantastic. And I said, can't we do something about this? Collectively, the five of us have over 2.5 million followers on social media. And we can
2.5 million.
Yeah. We can sit here and talk about the failure that our country is making about the refugee crisis in Europe, or we can do something about it ourselves. So we did. So in the course of 48 hours, right before Christmas, we raised over $2 million.
$2 million?
Oh, wait a minute. Let me make sure I've got that right. It's not $2 million. It's 1.4. We wanted to raise one, and it's 1.4, but it's still, people are still throwing. And the coolest bit about it was that this was Glennon's idea, her inspiration. No one was allowed to make a donation of more than $25.
Yes, I love that about
it. In order to prove how little it takes, to make a difference. And because I think sometimes people feel like, well, I'm not Angelina Jolie. What can I do? You can do something. And if you get together with this amazing network of people on social media, you can do even more. So we'll be doing more. But that was just a test to see if it works. Obviously,
so what
it works.
Will you do with that money now that you've raised it?
Well, we had sorted it out already. We're working with a fantastic British organization called Help Refugees. And this is something that Glennon, who has her own organization called Together Rising, she spent months researching to find what is the single most effective way that we can use this. We didn't want to just throw it at a huge NGO and have it be a drop in the bucket. So this is a group of people who came out of Bristol, England, some nurses, some carpenters, got, you know, basically just went to Lesbos, to the beach and said, we're here, what can we do?
Okay.
And so they had a very specific shopping list of things they needed. They needed floodlights to help pull people out of water when the boats come in. They needed heated tents so that when people come in on the tents, they can immediately get them warm because they couldn't keep these children warm. They needed winter clothes for the kids. They needed, you know, plywood to be able to build shelters. They needed, you know, it was so specific what they needed, and they were so hands-on, and because they're small and nimble, they could adjust with the crisis as it was going. They needed an ambulance. So they have all those things now. You know, and obviously we have a great deal further to go on this humanitarian crisis, but at least something.
And you may have further to go depending on the outcome of your election.
Yeah.
So I know everybody must be asking you this. I'm sorry, I have to ask you this, but what is your take on the reason for the Trump phenomenon? Why is he gaining this traction?
I think anybody who claims to know what's going on right now in the American presidential race is either delusional, deeply hopeful, terribly paranoid, or just wrong. Because none of us have any idea what's going on. You know, this is not, what's happening cannot be happening, and yet it is happening. And I take no consolation in, well, he couldn't possibly win, because he shouldn't even be where he is.
No.
What is happening is impossible, and yet it is happening. And my personal take on it is that I hope, that it's the last ugliest gasp of a dying part of my country. And that they're going down, as often happens when something is ending, they're going down fighting. And if we can defeat them once more, another 8 years will pass, and there'll be even more immigrants, and even more working women, and even more people to replace angry old white men.
About this in terms of your family,
yeah.
You know, I mean, your father is a Republican.
Yeah.
Is he horrified by what's going on?
He is, but he's also, like many Republicans, he hasn't been paying attention to what's happened to his party, and it's been a source of great frustration between me and my dad for a long while now. He still thinks that they are something that they have not been since basically the Eisenhower administration, in my view. You know, he just has been wearing blinders about what his party has become. And I think one of the interesting things that's happening right now is that you can no longer deny this. The only thing that shocks me is that these people are shocked. Like, haven't you seen the monster that you have made? And the rage that you've been exploiting for short-term gain and what you're creating. And look now, look what you have now. This is what you're, and you know, somebody, a thinking Republican the other day said, this cannot be the face of the Republican Party. And I wanted to say, and yet it has been for years. This is what you've become. So be honest with yourselves, you guys. This is what you've made, and this is what you've become, and now
look what you get.
Look what you get, and look what we all might get.
Yeah, that's the really scary thing.
Look what the whole world might get, because
exactly.
Whoever is the president of the United States has an impact on every single human being on Earth.
On a happier note, can you give us an update on how the dramatization of the Signatureville things is going?
I can, because I just read the first episode of, and it's beautifully, beautifully, beautifully done, and I am contractually bound to not speak of it in any way other than to say that the same lovely team of people who brought you Downton Abbey are working very hard to bring you the signature of all things.
So you're not allowed to tell us who's cast?
I
really
just
okay,
we'll let it go at that,
right?
And just say that it's happening, and
that's good.
You know, as of now, it definitely appears to be happening. I could not be happier with everybody who's involved with it, and it's going to be beautiful.
So I asked you to start with what you are reading now, but you've been in such a whirlwind with Big Magic, but and all the other things you've been doing. Have you started writing another book?
I'm working on the research for it at this point. I'm still probably 6 months away from beginning to write it. But yes, I'm working on a novel about New York City in the 1940s and about promiscuous young women in the theater world.
So was this the novel that was kind of hovering? I remember at one stage you had two books you wanted to write and you had to decide. One of them was obviously Big Magic.
Yeah.
And was this the other one? Because one of the big themes of Big Magic is if you leave an idea for too long, when you come back to it, it might have gone elsewhere.
You may have lost it, yeah. Which is why it felt urgent to sort of figure out. But I also feel like I'm always telling that people often come to me and say, I've got a bunch of like competing creative ideas and I don't know which one to do, and there's sort of neurosis anxiety around, if I do this, it's the wrong, how do I know if it's the right choice? And I always say, look, essentially you are the president of your own creative corporation and you are the decider. And so what I do in these cases when I have competing ideas is I make the ideas bring me their pitch, you know? What do you got? What do you want to be? And what you find when you do that, when you sit at the head of the boardroom table and you say, look, you're both blah, 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 but I need to know reality. Like, how far along are you? You know, what is this? How deep is this idea? How rich is this idea? How ridiculous is this idea? How serious is this idea? And then I listen to all the proposals and I have to say, look, there's only one of me.
Yeah.
I'm not going to divide my time and my energy and my power. So until you, this is what I said to Big Magic for 12 years, because it was this nagging sort of Mozzie idea that was hanging around me, and I just kept saying to it, until you are more than the vaguest notion, I'm turning my attention elsewhere. You know, get your shit together and come back to me with a legitimate proposal and I'll consider making you. But in the meantime, you're just annoying me while I'm trying to make things that actually have depth and, you know, a sort of morphs. But then suddenly last year, almost within a week, Big Magic finally came to me with a real proposal about what I wanted to be. So I was like, all right, let's do you. And then we'll turn back to the novel. So, but you have to be firm. You can speak back to these ideas. I think people get swept up in some sort of an idea that they're the hand puppet of the muse and that they, you know, it's a collaboration. You're allowed to push back. You're allowed to make demands and you're allowed to explain the realities of your situation. You don't have time to do everything.
You don't, but hurry up and write the novel then and come back and tell us about that next time.
I hope to.
Thank you very much, Elizabeth Gilbert.
Thank you, sweetheart. It's always a delight to talk to you.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.